The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to Glad Tidings, the Athletic's Everton Football Club podcast. It's me, Greg O'Keefe. I'm joined by a jubilant and victorious Paddy Boylan, and we've got a win to talk about. We might have sounded a touch pessimistic in the build-up. Who can blame us? Before we get going, I'm going to warn Paddy now, because obviously we like to see each other on these podcasts. We do it via Zoom. At some point, I'm going to be drinking this.
God, what even is that?
So I'm just, for the benefit of the camera, I'm just holding up the most vile-looking green smoothie that you'll ever see, and we'll see how that goes down. It's a new concoction I've created. It could go either way. Right. On some more pressing matters, Pad, did you enjoy the game on Sunday? I know we were both watching. Obviously, I did the piece, but you were watching with your dad and co. What do you think of it?
First of all, I'm really glad you described me as triumphant and jubilant. I don't think anybody's ever described me in such a way, so I am.
Arms held aloft as you walked into the kitchen to start the pot.
Still arms aloft now. No, I'm good. I'm good. It was obviously a much needed win, a win that keeps Everton right in the hunt, I'd suggest, for Europe. Yeah. If they'd lost, I think that would have been them cut adrift from West Ham, yeah, in particular. And the fact that they've won means that now, certainly, provided they get through the Aston Villa game unscathed, they can have a real tilt at probably the final Europa League place, if not more. So great to see Everton win, but great to see Everton beat a David Moyes West Ham side in particular. I think that always feels a little bit sweeter as well, doesn't it?
It does. there's a very small part of me, a very small part of me, that I almost felt sorry for David Moyes, because you could just imagine that it would have just felt like sod's law for him. You know, his team, the form team, you know, really flying going into the game. And then he gets old school moised in a way by a team that it doesn't really want the ball, is going to dig deep, defend well, and play kind of, actually, I don't like the phrase parasitic football in the old Mourinho way, but certainly the opposite of having the ball, which is what you might expect really when you go from a Moyes era to all of a sudden having one of the best club managers in history. But that's why I think Ancelotti is one of the best, really, because he knows how to cut his cloth accordingly. And it was dead interesting afterwards, wasn't it, Pad? Did you see? He's alluded to it before, but he just said up straight, we are not a possession team. We're not. It couldn't have been clearer. You know, he said, like it or lump it, essentially. And he said the correlation between possession and goals / winning isn't there. It's not in this sport. It's maybe for other sports. And he seems to be saying what you and I have said often on this podcast, that while we're a work in progress recruitment-wise, he's going to pick the team and the way of playing that he thinks will win.
I feel like we've said that on the podcast about 10 times. I feel as though I've written about 15 match pieces this season along those lines. So I mean, yeah, I entirely agree with what Ancelotti's saying there. And it does help, obviously, explain the difference between the form away from home and at home. That's now 11 wins on the road. 11 out of 17 heading into the game against Aston Villa on Thursday. And I think that at the moment, that's only one short of Everton's best record away from home in a league season, which is 12 in the 84-85 season, and another one in the 69-70, both of the winning season.
84-85, not much happened then, did it really?
No. And instead of Graham Sharp and Andy Gray up front, they've got Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison. And instead of Neville Southall, you've got Jordan Pickford. So this is a different era, Everton. But they got the win, and they continue to be effective in that more pragmatic style on the road. The question is, what comes at home? How do they get over the barrier at home? And that's been the story of the season, I guess. It's something that we're still to resolve at this late stage, but it'll be the challenge for next year, Tim.
Absolutely is the challenge, isn't it, to resolve that. And part of me thinks that when Rodriguez isn't fit, I just wouldn't even bother trying to play football, trying to dominate the ball at home or away. I just wonder why you just play to your strengths anywhere, especially when the fans aren't there and you don't feel any particular pressure to do it. There's going to come a point where you're going to have to be more progressive, and hopefully he's going to evolve the team to have better players that you are more comfortable with the ball.
This is the interesting thing about Ancelotti, though, isn't it? Because we've spoken a lot about identity, or a lack of identity in certain contexts. But if you're going to beat them by that stick, you also have to acknowledge that there are some benefits too. And those benefits are that he'll look at a side like West Ham and he'll be able to, in, on occasion at least, find ways to deal with their threat. Now, if Everton had opened up and really gone at West Ham, my feeling would be that they would have played right into Moyes' strengths and the strengths of this West Ham side. You think about West when West Ham are at their best, and it's when you've got the direct running of Lingard, Bowen, Antonio on the counter-attack. So Everton were never going to open up. Ancelotti's pragmatic. He knows that that's not really an option against West Ham. They have similar problems to Everton, by the way, insofar as the more of the ball they have, the less effective they tend to be. But the onus was on them at home, so all Everton did was get that goal. I thought they played pretty well first half, all things considered. And then, as we've seen, step back on the lead. Sometimes that works, sometimes it didn't. It doesn't, but on this occasion it did. And I thought Ancelotti got it just about spot on in the approach, just about spot on. Knew how to negate West Ham's weaknesses in the main, and knew as well, I thought it was quite interesting, he spoke after the game, and Calvert-Lewin as well spoke after the game, about that, the idea of getting in behind Dawson and Diop, moving them around. Kind of very good aerially dominant defenders, but players that aren't blessed with pace. Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison had a clear advantage on them, as we saw for the goal. So it was a game plan that worked. It was a game plan that helped them to 3 points. And like I say, that's what you get with Ancelotti. You get somebody that is going to be able to forge that kind of pragmatic blueprint when you need it more often than not.
Absolutely. And I think if we were to win our remaining 4 games in that manner, it got us into Europe, I don't think anyone would be complaining too much. In the long term, you've got to see some evolution, I think, to really compete for honours or to get into the top 4. Saying that, Leicester won the league not so long ago, playing very similar style of football, often would have 30, 40% possession. It's just about, you know, being honest and upfront and what suits you best.
Playing to the strengths of the players at your disposal at the moment. The qualities are, it's like the battling of a Ben Godfrey. It's the aerial prowess of Calvert-Lewin, the delivery of Luca Dean. At times, when he's fit, it's the quality on the ball, the creativity of James. But like you say, when he's not there, the other elements need to come to the foreground. I think that's why Ancelotti's right. They are a battling side more than a dominant front foot possession first side at this moment in time.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
We asked you earlier for some questions because we like to answer your questions and get your shout to what we should talk about. And you responded really well. So thank you very much. If we didn't get across to your question today in this podcast, please do persevere in the future and we will next time. But we'll start with Patrick Ridge, who asked a topical one, actually. Is Davies the most important midfielder for the run in? Pad, I'll let you start with this one because Tom Davies, we've both written a lot about. He's a player that you've long championed, really. And, you know, we wrote about him earlier in the season, about his improvements. They were all there to see again on Sunday. Everton were a better team for him in it.
They absolutely were. I think we spoke about this on last week's pod. The balance didn't seem right in central areas when it was Alan and Gomez as a partnership. It just didn't give Everton enough solidity. We said that Alan likes to push forward, win back possession, and that can often leave loads of space in between the lines. When you've got somebody like Gomez there, Gomez is not maybe positionally intelligent or mobile enough to cover that ground. Davis has been some of those things this season. He's grown into that number 6 role. What was really clear to me from the West Ham game was the extent to which Davis's presence in that midfield freed Alan up to do even more. And I think there's a bit, I'm going to write about this later this week because I think it's an interesting topic, but there's this thing with Alan where he is a destroyer in some sense of the word. He does win back possession, but he is also more than just being a number 6. I mean, some of the runs forward, there were probably 2 or 3 runs forward. As Greg gets ready to drink his pungent green combination, There were some great runs forward from Alan where he took 2-3 opposition players out of the game at the London Stadium.
Yeah.
There was also, I don't know if you remember it, there was a fantastic ball clipped with the outside of his foot to Richarlison over the top of the defence. And
yes, I do actually. It was a lovely pass, though, wasn't it?
In the first half too. He's a really good footballer, and I think sometimes we forget this when he plays in that kind of destroyer, that number six role. So Davis being there allowed him to play that position. I feel Doucouré does as well. I feel if you've got Doucouré alongside Alan, you've obviously got more legs, you've got more energy, you've got a problem solver alongside him, so he's intelligent enough to sit deep. So I think it doesn't matter if it's Davis or Doucouré, but what's quite clear to me is it needs one of them to get the most out of Alan in these final games. I don't care which. I think it'd be hard for Davis and harsh for him to lose his place after that match, but equally, Doucouré's arguably being Everton's most important midfielder this year as well. So I don't know if Davis is the most important, but he's certainly a player of his ilk is going to be key to getting the most out of Alan, I feel. What do you think?
No, I totally agree. Probably the most important might be overstating it a little bit, but the fact that he was able to step in to... Obviously, Doucouré wasn't risked on Sunday despite being back in training and to all intents and purposes fit, maybe not match fit. I thought Tom's performance was massive. I'm all here now for why he's an important member of the squad going forward. In another world, he might have left last summer. He might have gone on loan in January. But Carlo stood firm and said he wanted him around, and we can see why now. So moving on, Terry McAllister asks, considering the current financial climate, will Everton be able to bring in 3 to 4 first-teamers again this summer? I presume that given the climate he's talking about, obviously the impact of COVID on all clubs, Everton included, the commitment to spending on the stadium. Will Everton be able to bring in 3 to 4 first-teamers again this summer? I'll sort of start. I think they need to, it would be my opinion. They need 3 or 4 players that, you know, we said so often, we need the right back, a right winger, or a wide player who can probably play off either side and scores goals. I would suggest they need another central midfielder, although without sounding like a broken record, I suppose Gbamon is still there, but maybe it's not someone who replaces Gbamon, as opposed to bring a lot more pace and attacking quality into the central midfield. We don't score goals from central midfield. We don't assist from central midfield. I think Gomez's place in the squad, for me, has to be in question. And, you know, the suggestions that he's looking at another centre-back, we'll see what happens in that regard. Will we be able to do it? I think it's all about, Pad, and I'm interested to get your take. I think it's all about how we do it. We're not going to go out and spend 30 million times 4. I don't think that's going to happen. But look at the way they were creative around doing deals last summer. Look at the way they did the deal for James Rodriguez. There's ways and means of going about it. And you know, Brands and Mashiri will do everything, I think, to get Carlo the players that he wants.
Yeah, well, I think, interestingly, Ancelotti has spoken quite a lot about this already in the last few weeks. And he's gone on record as saying 2 to 3 first team is needed this summer if Everton are to kick on, in his opinion. I'm kind of the same opinion as you. I think particularly if they were to get Europe, that would need to rise to 3 or 4, because we're not even talking about fringe players here or just getting squad depth in place. I think you look at maybe certainly the right side, the whole right side of the team, regardless of how well Seamus Coleman's done in recent months, that's in need of a big upgrade and starting quality upgrade, you'd say, particularly on the right side of midfield. But you've listed other positions there. And the other one I'd like to highlight, you've got a situation with Moise Keane this summer where Ancelotti's already said he will not stand in Keane's way if he does want to leave Goodison and the right offer comes in. Cenk Tosun, who almost certainly would have left either on another loan deal or on a permanent deal, he's now injured and probably out until October time. So, I mean, the end result's the same whether he leaves or not. He's not going to be able to contribute to the Everton squad. That leaves Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison as your two strikers. That's not enough. That's not enough for a Premier League season, never mind Europa League or European Conference League, whatever it's called, the new Farmers League there. what an enticing prospect that is. So I suppose the question's asking, is that feasible? What I would say is I think they'll be confident that they'll get the 2 to 3 in. And I think the rest will very much depend on what happens in terms of outgoings. Let's say, for example, Moise Keane were to leave for 30, 40 million pounds. That's 30 to 40 million that in theory could be at least in part reinvested on an additional player. And as well as saying that they need 2 to 3, Ancelotti's already pinpointed last year as the blueprint. and the kinds of sums spent on players there. So we're not talking about 50, 60 million. In theory, it's 20 here, 20 there, a bargain deal if they can afford it, potentially even more, rising to 20, 25, 30. That's the blueprint. I don't think that the funds are there in the financial climate, and given Everton's own issues financially over the last 5 years or so, I don't think the funds are there to go mad, but unless they were to sell really, really big. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be really, really interesting, but I think we'll see additions, and I think we'll see additions in key parts of the pitch, and hopefully they're as successful as maybe a Doucouré or a Ben Godfrey and can help Everton push forward.
If they can be half as successful as those two, then I think we'll be looking good. So other than Bernard and Keane, do we expect to see any other high-profile departures this summer? That's Robbie Taylor. We'll get to Wayne's question in a second. So, I mean, Paddy mentioned Moise Keane and his situation. Bernard, I think we expect him to move on, don't we, Pad?
I think so. He obviously came very close to doing so in January. Certainly, if you look at Everton's financial model at the moment, I think where it needs the biggest improvement is in terms of making sure that the guys that are on the periphery and are not performing for whatever reason, but are on high contracts and big salaries, are kind of cut adrift, if at all possible. Bernard obviously fits into that category quite neatly because he was a free agent. He came in on a good salary, a very good salary even. And he's not first choice by any stretch of the imagination. So I think losing players like him will be a priority. I guess to answer the rest of the question, what does a high-profile departure mean? Would a departure of Moise Keane be high-profile? Well, yes, probably it would. And we've already said that that's probably one way that Everton can look to bring in funds. Does high-profile, in terms of the rest of the squad, mean, like, let's say, for example, a shock departure of Luca Dean or Calvert-Lewin? Well, we've had no indication at this stage to suggest that either those two players would be likely to leave. They're both on big deals and new contracts, relatively new contracts. And then it's the rest of the squad. You look at the rest of the squad, I think they're going to lose Theo Walcott. They're going to lose Yannick Bolasie. The key thing there is that while you're not getting transfer fees for those guys that come to the end of the contract, you are recouping sizable wages. And I think this summer, the challenge for all teams is going to be losing players that they no longer want, finding buyers or permanent homes for players they no longer want. Because I think that market was massively saturated last summer. It was just, there's no wiggle room. Everton weren't able to do the business in terms of outgoings that they would have wanted. And they've already pointed to that. They pointed to that in the general meeting back in January. They said how difficult it was and how effectively, although the Premier League held relatively firm with spending power, the likes of Serie A, Bundesliga and La Liga, three big buying markets for Premier League talent, just completely fell off a cliff. And I've seen no evidence to suggest that that's likely to change this summer. So I think that, I don't know what you think, but for me, that's going to be the big issue. Even if Everton wanted to lose kind of high profile fringe players, are they going to be able to find locations for them?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's absolutely, and that's the challenge facing Marcel Brands. It seems perpetually to be the challenge facing Marcel Brands in a football manager sense. You know, you move one off the books, you move bring one in, and it all sounds very straightforward, but obviously it's not the case. It's easier said than done. The challenge, of course, might be, as something I wrote about last week, is keeping hold of some of your players if you don't get Europe. So there's, you know, players like Richarlison. Luca Dean's on a nice big new contract. However, that doesn't mean if an offer were to come in, he might not fancy it. If in a Champions League club we're pushing, it just protects Everton.
But Charleston's going to want to play Champions League football at some point. I mean, Calvert-Lewin will want to. I mean, that's not being alarmist. That's just how players are. But everybody, you would hope, everybody is ambitious.
Exactly. And don't forget, it was only last summer Richarlison was talking about giving Everton one more season in terms of the progress, or giving Ancelotti one more season. Now, I can hear a lot of you now saying, well, he hasn't exactly pulled up trees this season.
And they're right, by the way.
And they're absolutely right. But on that point, we'll get on to Wayne Ellis's question, the last one for this pod of your Q&A. What do you make of the relationship between Dom and Richarlison on the field? Now, you and I were chatting after the game on Sunday, Pad. I ended up writing about it, and we were chatting about it. You know, you were talking about how effective they were as a duo, and they really were, weren't they? It was one of Richarlison's better games, albeit without scoring. and there was still the odd running into a dead end. But that running was there. The attitude was back on track. And he did exactly, seemed to me to do exactly what was asked of him. And Ancelotti alluded to that afterwards, didn't he?
Yeah, I think this was the best Richarlison that we've seen for a good while. And certainly it wasn't perfect. I mean, it was much better in the first half, by the way, than after the break, where Everton retreated and didn't really give them much possession. But what we saw and what I really liked was the way he was alleviating pressure by getting Everton up the pitch. We know he is capable of doing that. He's a strong runner with the ball. He's not lightning quick, but he is, I'd say, on the quicker end of the spectrum when it comes to Premier League strikers. We know full well when he's got the bit between his teeth and he's aggressive in his approach, he can really ruffle feathers and he can really provide a real headache for opposition teams. Saw that quite a lot in the first half. Thought there was some great link-up play where Calvert-Lewin would go short and would flick it on. One example was a shot from Richarlison where he turned Diop and Fabianski to make a save. And I also thought it was the best we've seen from Calvert-Lewin for a good while too. The issue for me is that I still think when it's instinctive and when it's, let's say, for example, Calvert-Lewin flicking onto Richarlison, they look really good in tandem. Maybe where they are lacking a little bit still is in the final killer pass when they've got more time on their hands. So there were a few times in the second half when one of them broke into space, looked up, and the other was making a run off the shoulder and they didn't make the pass. I don't think that's because, as some people were weirdly suggesting on Twitter, they don't want to pass to each other. That, I just don't think that's the case at all. What I would say is I just think it's maybe because they either believe that they don't have the ability to make that pass or that they're just so focused on getting their head down and making ground that they perhaps don't make the best decision. Calvert-Lewin, some of Calvert-Lewin's passing though was fantastic. I mean, there was a ball through to Coleman, a shot that was ultimately blocked. I thought that was a fantastic pass. And another one where he rounded the keeper and squared for Josh King to head against the post. We've not seen loads of that from Calvert-Lewin. It's certainly an element of his game that I feel if he's to become a top, top, top striker, he's going to need to develop. But we are seeing signs that he's still only 23, that he's able to do that. And he's potentially got that in his locker. I also thought the finish, by the way, I'm not always 100% confident when he goes through on goal. When he's got a bit more time on his hands and where he's got to make a decision, pick a corner. I think he's better at the instinctive stuff around the six-yard box. But on this occasion, he was just razor sharp and really, really clinical. So Calvert-Lewin growing, Calvert-Lewin showing signs that he can become even more than the top quality striker he is now. And Richarlison picked up again as well. If Everton are to get into Europe, they need those two guys to link in tandem like they were at the London Stadium.
Yeah, I totally agree. That was a really important display from both of them and it showed what they can offer. So let's hope that Richarlison can sort of keep that consistency in the run-in. Thanks very much for your questions again. Really appreciate it. We've obviously got another massive game on Thursday. They just keep coming thick and fast, don't they? You wait all that time for a bus or a game against Villa and then two come along at once. We only played them the other week. Less said about that, the better. If you're feeling particularly upbeat and want to be deflated, listen to our podcast when we picked over the bones of the Villa defeat. Let's hope for an entirely different outcome at Villa Park on Thursday. It needs to be, obviously. And he made that point, didn't he, straight away after the game. Ancelotti, there was no particular kind of resting on laurels. I felt he'd made the players aware how important the game at West Ham was. Maybe he'd lit a little bit of fire underneath them. And he made the point that it needs to be the same in the Midlands. Big game. Goes without saying, but it's a big game, isn't it?
Yeah, they all are at this stage. I think 3 points gained or 3 points dropped could ultimately be the difference between qualifying for Europe or not. And Ancelotti's made that abundantly clear to the players now. They're left in no uncertain terms as to what he expects from them in the final four games. As it is now, an opportunity, a quick, very quick opportunity to right the wrongs of the game at Goodison, where I just thought Villa were comfortably the best side and thoroughly deserved their win. What you have to say is that if it follows the pattern of the season so far, this match at Villa Park suits Everton more because it allows them to do what they did against West Ham and look to exploit gaps when the opposition come onto them. As we've said repeatedly, that's when Everton are at their best. So I wouldn't expect a massive deviation from Carlo, particularly with the success of the three at the back. And Ollie Watkins is suspended, which obviously helps. Jack Grealish is close to coming back. He might feature in some form on Thursday, which is a blow. But isn't the schedule just ludicrous? I mean, Everton have got a situation where they're playing three games in 7 days, two of which are away from home and involve quite a fair amount of travelling. It's a tough ask for any team. Manchester United, I think, have got 4-9 or 4-8. And that's just the symptom for me of the way the season spiraled a little bit out of control, how COVID has impacted. And when sides are playing catch-up like Everton and Manchester United are, they're in a worse position because inevitably they've got fewer points on the board and are having to make ground. And they make ground in midweek, sandwiched in between two other games. Not entirely fair, but that's what it is. It's what it is. And I think what we'll need is, because there's a game Thursday, there's a game Sunday evening, what we'll need is somebody like a Doucouré to come back and provide extra legs and extra energy. There'll need to be a few tweaks here or there. Maybe you see, for example, Yerry Mina. He obviously picked up a knock. Maybe you see him make way for a Mason Holgate. Maybe you see, I don't know, a Josh King get more game time, more minutes at some point. And they're going to need to, where possible, use the squad and try and navigate a way through. So the success or failure of these next two games for me will be based on who they have fit, who's able to play, and how the players that do come into the picture a little bit more fair. We need to see more from Josh King. We need to see more from people like Alex Iwobi. Can they provide that in these final games of the season? Let's see.
Indeed, let's see. Well, I did mention at the top, but there's been loads of good stuff, if we don't say so ourselves, on the site recently. Last Friday was an absolutely cracking piece Paddy did with Mark Carey. Should mention it. If you haven't read it yet, honestly, it answers a question I think every Evertonian has asked in frustration at some point this season. And the headline says it all. Why are Everton so slow? Let us explain. And I'd say Paddy and Mark do a very good job of doing so. It got some really interesting traction and feedback, that piece, didn't it? It was like being spoken about in the game by people as well. It was illuminating, wasn't it, Pat?
Yeah, and I know the results, because we were able to, with the help of a data provider used by a lot of the Premier League clubs, we were able to chart the top speeds recorded by every single performer in the Everton squad this season, and Luca Dean came out on top, and that was obviously a big surprise to some. I think if you asked most Everton fans or people that follow Everton week in, week out, they'd almost certainly have gone for a Ben Godfrey, a Dominic Calvert-Lewin, and I would have said the same, to be honest. But what I would say, the big caveat is that, I mean, you can cover, but what this stat doesn't tell you is how much distance is covered when making that sprint. So it might only be a 5-yard dash. That's just absolutely rapid. And that's probably the case with somebody like Luca Dean. We all know that Godfrey and Calvert-Lewin are quick. We all know that Richarlison's quick by Premier League standards. But the other thing to point out, and I did want to make this abundantly clear when writing, was that actually the stylistic stuff at work here, Everton press far less now under Ancelotti than they did when Marco Silva was in charge. They don't score. I know they did at the weekend, but they don't score many direct attacks, i.e. counter-attack moves. They tend to be few and far between for this Everton side. So it does show that they, on top of maybe needing a bit of an injection of pace on the wings and in certain forward areas, they probably need as well to look at, if they were to get those players in, adapting the style to something a bit more aggressive and energetic. But enjoyed it. And like you say, lots of stuff on the site. Really good read from you with Dale Jennings, the former Tranmere and Bayern Munich player. That's one to definitely check out. And yeah, I finished writing something on Ellis Sims, the striker on loan at Blackpool today. We're going to do something on Alan, as I promised earlier, later in the week. So keeping that Everton page going, keeping other Athletic pages going, and obviously the focus very soon is on Aston Villa and Sheffield United. If Everton come out with 4 to 6 points from those games, then they're still in the mix, aren't they? So that's going to be the aim.
Absolutely. Well, Paddy's off to analyse Alain. I'm off to drink that green gloop that we mentioned earlier. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Don't forget, listeners to the pod can get a 40% discount to read all our Everton coverage on The Athletic. You only need to go to theathletic.com/EvertonPod to subscribe for £3.99 a month. That's theathletic.com/EvertonPod. Thank you very much for listening. And here's to another, hopefully, 3 points on Thursday.
The Athletic.